Hi, I'm Sharon. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, and thanks for all four waters, you guys. Somebody knows me. I'm a guzzler. And I never save a lid. So there you go. Okay. I feel so honored to be with my tribe, you guys. Thank you. John and Cindy have known for a long time, watched the family grow up, and there's Jim is in the room, and I'm privileged to sit every Wednesday with Jim Shaw Jr. in our meeting and look in his eyes and stay on him. I stay on him for Jim, you know, I stay on him, make sure he's showing up and look in his eyes. So just so you all know that, Jim Shaw Jr. is doing well. And I have so many people in this room I love so much, and I've gotten a lot of hugs and little miracles are sitting in the room all over the place. And that's, hang on. Props, you know. That's it. The Age of Miracles is still with us. That's your banner this year. And you know, and I like to remember that a miracle isn't, you know, well, when Roland went to see Carl Jung way back before Alcoholics Anonymous and he needed a spiritual experience to stay sober, and Dr. Jung said, well, the only way to do it is, you know, to have a spiritual experience because you're an alcoholic and I can't help you. And poor Roland said, okay, I'll build a church. I'll give all my money to the church. And Dr. Jung said, nope, not going to work that way. He said, well, and what? I've got, you know, I can do anything. I've got a lot of money. And he said, you got to put yourself on the spiritual path and hope lightning strikes you. And I think, okay, you know, that's pretty sincere. He was waiting for a miracle. And here we sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the middle of God's country, this beautiful part of the world, with each other, with our history and with a new history we're making, and we're making, miracles are happening, right, sitting all around us right now. I mean, we can go anywhere in the world as sober alcoholics and not be alone, unless you want to be, and that's your choice. And I feel so privileged to be living in a day and age where there's so much hope for us as alcoholics. And, you know, you're my people. You're the people that show up and drive and act better than you feel and, you know, part of the force for good. I mean, you're the people out there doing it. And that's where I fit. I fit with you. I fit all weekend with you. You know, it's very rejuvenating for me. I feel like you're putting a lot of logs in my fire and I'm putting a lot on yours. And it's burning brightly, you know, it's burning brightly. And I, and the people that follow the glimmer of their own candle that's just not where I am in life. I'm a more alcoholic. I like tequila and Harley Davidsons, rebellion, defiance. I am a more kind of alcoholic. And I'm a more kind of sober woman alcoholic. I like to go further, go deeper, go higher, keep going, because there's just so much to do in this world. And if you're bored, you're probably boring. So get moving. There's a lot to do. There's a lot to do. So you're my people, definitely. And I feel very much loved. And I wouldn't let anybody ever near me to break my heart again. And you know what? It gets broken and put back together all the time here. Because, you know, the speakers have just been awesome. Awesome. And I think about, you know, I think about the meetings I go to and where are the people. Where did they go? Where have they been? And, you know, and I know people that have had a lot of time that have gone back out, and if they get back, they're lucky. And, you know, I know Johnny's with us with about 30 hours, and he's sitting over here, and first aid's over there. So I hope, you know, if we have a seizure going, you guys, get ready. He's over here, you're over there. So, you know, when I sobered up in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975, it was a good night at Ohio Street in West Los Angeles when we had a seizure. You know, it was like, all right, you know. We got them. They come to, where am I? AA, all right. You know, it's like... What's that? Just sit down, shut up, and listen, you know. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, Johnny, I want to let you know, my jaw was wired shut for the first 3 months. I couldn't talk, and I had to learn to listen. And that was a blessing. So take the cotton out of your ears, put it in your mouth. I used to say that a lot, and just sit with us, hang on to the seat. Like Steve said, don't leave, and you can have a huge roaring fire in your heart to share and make a difference in this world. And that's all I ever wanted to do, was make a difference. I was a little girl in Iowa that was obsessed with Gandhi. You know, it's like I was a little different than the other kids. But I knew I wanted to somehow make a difference. You know, I'm in the heartland where there's so much food, and I'm trying to, like, you know, starve myself like Gandhi, you know, and suffer, you know. So I was really happy when I found alcohol because I didn't have to make a difference anymore. The difference was made. I was on a spiritual search, and the difference was made. Alcohol was spiritual for me. Filled me up from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes, and I had instant courage, and I could do anything. I could do anything. Alcohol worked for me. And you were talking about Everclear, and my I was watering down bottles and stealing alcohol and drinking rubbing alcohol because it said alcohol on it when I had a hangover. No one taught me any of this. I come from a non-alcoholic family, but I just took to it like a duck to water. And, you know, it was the 60s, you know, when I was growing up. And I know maybe a few of you, you know, remember the 60s. You know, I guess I said if you remember the 60s, you weren't really there. But, you know, you know, it wasn't just say no, it was just say thanks. We took a lot of stuff with our alcohol. And I always asked for more. And I always asked for more. But what started happening was I started to... Everything in my life that meant something to me, you know, that line in the sand that, you know, I don't really talk. I drank in places where we don't talk about our feelings. I don't know about you, but, you know, I'm drinking in places where somebody says, how are you, or what are you drinking, and they, you know, how you feeling. You know, I'm not going to say I'm lonely. I'm intense, you know. It's like, what's it to you, you know. But we were all best friends in that bar, you know. We were all best friends. I drank with a lot of, you know, brain surgeons and astronauts and... Queens, and you know, I was in New Orleans, a lot of Queens, and which brings me to another point. Joe was talking about the dance pictures from the Men's Stag, and it's like it sounds like a script for, you know, Queer Eye for the Sober Guy or something, you know. It's just I'll have to see that later. That'll keep me up, probably. Nightmares. But it was the 60s, and I couldn't wait to get out there. I'm musically talented. I had some art talent. I'm one of four children in a non-alcoholic family. I'm in Iowa. I'm looking for the mothership because I know they're going to come get me. They made a mistake. And I cannot wait. I cannot wait to break loose. And alcohol allowed me to do that long before I ever really left. But I left. Eventually I left. And, you know, in the big book it talks about all the geographics in chapter 3 and trying this and trying that. And I tried a lot of different things. I didn't know that's where... I was always writing a book. That's what I told my mother. I'm writing a book. After a couple of years in college, I had had a huge fight with my father. I had broken his heart. I changed my name one night. I woke him up at, I don't know, 2 in the morning. I drove in from the university and I woke him up and... And I said, I got to talk to you. And this is a little country house and outside of a little town in Iowa. And they thought, what am I doing home, and why do I have to talk to him at 2 in the morning? And so they came out and sat at the kitchen table, and you know, I'm dragging this friend with me who's, you know, his eyes are spinning in circles, and he doesn't have any shoes on. It's like February. And I said, I have to talk to you. And my dad's looking at this guy like she didn't elope. She couldn't, no, please, no, you know. And I said, okay, we're having a new relationship now. We're going to have a new relationship, no more mom and dad, and no more Sharon, okay? You're going to be Marge, and you're going to be Frank, and I'm going to be Cher. Not like Sonny and Cher. Cher, S-H-A-R-E, like Cher and Cher alike. Got that, Dad, you know? And he's looking at what I'm sharing with, and he's just setting that jaw, and he... kind of looked askance at us, and he went off, and my mother just went, oh, Sharon, you know, she went off. I'm going, what? You guys want me to share with you? You want me to talk to you? You want me to bring you into my life? I mean, they only took me to the family doctor and psychiatrist, and I had a suicide attempt, and I fought with a Catholic priest, and I got drunk with another one, and I'm just trying to open up to you guys. What's wrong with you, you know? And alcoholism is so extremely selfish and self-centered. And they say when an alcoholic takes a drink, 10 people are immediately affected. And I think it's much more than that. So if you're in the room, it's not about you anymore. Sorry, but it's just not about you anymore. And I was so self-absorbed, and, you know, and I kept hitting these emotional bottoms with my family and people that love me, and, you know, and I was so defiant. It was, you know, the bottom kept, I wasn't really on top of it. It was like I would try to lower my standards quicker than I would be hitting bottom, you know, and my consequences were right in front of me, in front of my family, and it was painful for them. I'm a mom today. I can't imagine going through what I put my parents through. And I'm not hurting anyone but me. Leave me alone. And I was out there running and breaking my father's heart, especially. He had the biggest heart and the biggest shoulders, the patriarch of the family, and you can just take it, Dad. You know, this is what I'm doing. And I had the FBI watching my house in college. They would come talk to my father. My brother saw my dossier once. He said it was about 2 inches thick. I didn't know any of that. But I was always lying. I was always lying. And it was always about me. And I ended up taking geographics because I couldn't stand to go home anymore. I couldn't stand it. They just, you know, my dad and I couldn't look in the eye. And my mother would just, you know, she'd try to sew my clothes and find out what I was doing, and I just, I was such a taker. I robbed their soul, but I could justify every piece of what I was doing, and it was, you know, I was hitchhiking all over, and I landed in New York, and I came back to college, and couldn't paint, and ended up in Colorado, and couldn't play any more instruments, and my dignity's gone, and I'm in California with a guy who I think was Bob Dylan. I'm not really sure, but looked like him, sang like him. You know, Summary was missing. I think it was him, but, you know, I didn't ask to see his driver's license, so. And you just don't ask Bob for his driver's license, you know. But we ended up at a commune, and he went his way and I went mine, and the commune asked me to leave because I was the drunk. You know, they were just smoking that stuff and being mellow, and I was, like, drunk and drinking their bong wine and being really rowdy, and they tapped me on the shoulder and said, you got to leave. I was like, what? And so they gave me a dog, and we hitchhiked back to Colorado. And I was talking with Polly today. She and I went to Aspen a few years ago, and we went and found that cabin where I lived. And we went and found the trailer by the Roaring Fork River where I lived. And my roommate, who would wait behind the door with a knife when I would come in, and I would just, like, look at him and go, get over it. You know, it's, you know, people would have a gun in their hand, and it's like, just put it away. It was just like there was no reality in my life. And the harder it got and the more dark it got, the better I liked it now, because I had my heart broken. I walled it up. I walled up my heart. And there was no way anyone was going to get that. And, you know, I don't care. You want to fight? I'll fight. I don't care. And I didn't really have any sense of God in my life. I had left God in the Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, because I had a huge fight with that priest. And I said, forget that. I don't care. And I hitchhiked a lot. I ended up, Steve was talking about those prayers, and you know, I remember praying, too. You know, I'm a crisis Christian. You get me outside of Pensacola, Florida, with two guys and shotguns coming back to get the poor hitchhiking girls they left off. And we're, like, face down in the mud as they're standing 20 feet away from us with shotguns looking for us. I'll pray. That's when I'll pray. You know, and then when it rains and they leave and we're at a bar, we're laughing about it. You know, we're laughing about it. And It's actually Norm Alpe that talked about seconds and inches. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the speaker that would just light up the room would talk about seconds and inches, and I thought, yeah, okay, I get it. I didn't relate it to getting sober, but I related it to surviving long enough to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, but getting sober for each one of us takes this, you know, it takes a miracle. It takes preparation. It takes consequences. It takes us, our eyes being open. It takes surrender. I don't know about you, but I don't put my fist to my side. I don't wave a little white flag. You know, I'm ready to fight. I'm ready to go. I'm a middle child. I'll prove myself. I run alone. Maybe I've got a dog that hasn't been hit by a car recently, or a new dog that hasn't heard about the old dog, you know, come along. And, you know, my pets used to bite the dust a lot. I had turtle crawl through my white powder, and, you know, and I came to, and the little turtle's in the middle. He got stuck in the middle of this bunch of white powder, but, you know, and poke at him that next morning, and he's stiff, and, you know, but he had a little smile on his face, so he was all right, you know, and so I had to go bury him with a spoon in a park, and I went and gave the other one away to a pet store. I said, please take it. I'm going to kill it. You know, and they said, all right, lady. I used to take him with me on airplanes and let him run around the little tray and drink Jack Daniels and tell the stewardesses to shut up and leave me alone, bring me some more Jack Daniels, and, oh, God. You know, I don't live like that anymore. You know, I don't live like that anymore. I live in God's light, and you know, my day coming to you was August 20th, 1975. I could not have planned it. I couldn't have put it together. I couldn't have scripted it. I couldn't have made it happen. And each one of us, by seconds and inches, have our day. It's such a precious gift. Because I think of all the people that had a day and then forgot they had a day. And there, you know, I don't know. The girl that got me to AA had 8 chances. And if God would have tapped her on the shoulders, going out the door, number 8, back out the door again. You know, this is it, Chris. You're not coming back unless you stay. Would she have hung onto the seat? Come on, midnight. Come on, midnight. You know, we all have those days. Would she have been able to do that, or was the call of the wild too great for her? And she didn't have that moment of letting it all go, that surrender where it's like, you know, nowhere to turn. Nowhere to turn. I don't know, but we're the lucky ones sitting in here tonight. We've each had our day, precious day. Hang on to that day. Hang on to the seat. You know, and it's just, I just ended up in crazy places doing crazy things with crazy people. Organic farms, carnival, joined the carnival. I too was like, you know, grew my own crop. And then I forgot it when I was on my big deal. I forgot it. I left it back at the farm. I was drinking a little too much wine. I ended up with this carnival running a shooting gallery where I can put my tequila underneath my joint, and my new dog is here. And you know, we roll into town for 3 or 4 nights, and we blow out of town. And by then, that's the way I like to live. I can't stand to look in the mirror. I can't stand to call home. My mother's crying now. My father and I haven't sat at the same breakfast table or dinner table or grandma's Thanksgiving now for years. Years. I call home. If he answers, the phone is handed to my mother because I broke my dad's heart right in front of his face. And because that's what alcohol allowed me to do. And I don't know why I was so angry and why I was so upset and why, but that alcohol just allowed me for a moment, as you talked about, Steve, have that peace for just a moment. Lauren Bacall show up in that back bar mirror. You know, there she is. All right. Where's Humphrey? Let's find me and Humphrey for the night. And life is so different than that. But I love the bars, and I love the lies, and I love the insanity, and I love the ripping off, and I love the craziness, and I love the being up so I wouldn't miss truth, and I'm a seeker, and I'm looking for truth, and you know, when you find it, it usually melts before you can write it down, and, you know, I found truth a lot of times, but I forgot where I put it, you know, it just never, ever stuck with me, and the truth was I'm an alcoholic, and I didn't know that. Nobody knew of my disease. If Sharon could just meet a nice guy, or just maybe come home and go to teacher's college, or, you know, maybe just not take those drugs, and You know, and I'm an alcoholic, and no one knows that because I'm breaking my family in. They have no idea. And I ended up in New Orleans after I had been busted for drugs in Bogalusa, Louisiana. And it was a felony because they thought I was selling it because I had so much. But it was just mine, my stash, you know. A little trading, a little bartering here and there, but it was I wasn't selling it. And I'm in there about a week, and they handcuffed me and took me to this office where there was an attorney and my father was sitting there. And my dad had to get on a plane in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, fly into probably Chicago, fly into New Orleans, rent a car, look at a map, where is this daughter, where's Bogalusa, somewhere in the middle of the state, bring his checkbook. And he just did the right thing because that's the kind of man he was. And I sat there next to him that day. I don't remember what was said. I just remember I would try to look at him out of the corner of my eye, and I think he was trying to look at me out of the corner of his eye. We didn't hug. We didn't touch. I didn't cry on his shoulder and tell him, I'm sorry. I don't know what I'm doing. I need help. I asked my dad about that day many years later, many, many, many years into sobriety. I have been walked through my amends by the best people because I didn't go home and open wounds. I did not make amends about me, even though I wanted to, you know. I was really schooled and walked through amends with good sponsorship. And so when I was 20 years sober, I asked my dad about that day. I got permission to talk to my father about that day because we had an awful lot of years together before I brought that moment up, which is, you know how we bring things up. Well, Dad, I don't know if you remember. Yeah. It's like you Al-Anons, you guys were there, you know? And those looks that I used to get, I used to think they were like judgment looks, you know, but now that I know, and now that I've been on the other side of it too, it's the looks of, what the hell are you doing to yourself, you know, you're crazy. And then there's some compassion thrown in there too, but of course he remembered that day. He said, what did I say? He said, you told me you weren't guilty and it wasn't your fault. And that was my answer to what they found in the room and what they found on me and this felony that I'm now... a convicted felon, and I'm dancing on Bourbon Street in New Orleans, and I'm drinking, and I'm angry and upset, and I found an angry, upset guy to bond with, and, you know, we liked each other for 2 weeks, and we beat each other up for 2 years after that, but it was love. I'd sit in a bar, and I'd be so mad at him, I'd be drunk, and my New Orleans buddies, I had two female friends, Robin and Denny, and they would say, leave that guy, leave that jerk, you don't need him, and I'll go, yeah, I don't need him, and then... deep in my heart, he was all I had. This crazy, insane relationship. And my mom and dad went to Texas and thought they'd come over and see if daughter number two was okay. And they came over and they stood outside my apartment door above this biker bar, mousetrap bar, where it was just craziness all the time. And next to, you know, we lived in a tar paper roof apartment above this bar. And there were two other apartments. We had a lady of the evening who entertained. We had the bartender would drive his bike up the stairs into his, you know, screen door. And then there was me and the love of my life and my new black eye and his new black eye and the snake loose and the skunk running around and the dog and just insane stuff, you know. And that skunk, oh, it didn't like my dog and it didn't like me. It should have been a clue. And you know, his name was Crank. Crank that stank. And one day I put my foot off the side of the bed, and you know what I found, what we all found on our hike today, a lot of skunk scat. And I took that skunk by the tail, rolled him around, flung him to the wall, and he hit like a cartoon, you know, just splat, and he kind of slid down. I knocked him out, you know, and I'm like over there with this little skunk who's knocked out, thinking I'm trying to give him mouth to mouth. I didn't know what to do, you know, and then it wakes up, and it's like, it wants to bite me, and then he saw that, and he wants to come over and, you know, give me a new black eye, and he's got a cast on, so I want to take a knife and taunt him, and this is the way I live. This is the little girl in Iowa that could be whatever she wanted to be growing up. This is the one who won art contests. This is the one who won state championships. And this is the little girl that could do whatever she wanted to do growing up, and this is now I am living in insanity with my father who won't come into this apartment and my mother who's crying. And I also found out four years ago that my little brother and little sister were on that trip. And I was just absolutely horrified that I didn't remember them being there. So I had, you know, new amends to make. And I think about all the blackouts I was in and the self-obsessed moments that I had and all the people I probably damaged along the way of my drinking that I will never, ever get to make direct amends to. And you're talking about outliving them. But you know what? I get on a daily basis ways to make amends to the world and to show up and to be of service to God's kids. And as Chuck C. used to say, it's not my job to judge who gets it and who doesn't get it. I'm just supposed to look for the next beam of light and be of service. That's very, very simple. I am an action. I am a verb in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am an action-oriented human being. And if somebody needs something done, whether I'm not going to take their resume, find out if they're sober, are they nice to their mother, get in the traffic, okay, you know, and whatever needs to be done, because I may not ever get a chance to make amends for all those blackouts I was in. And my little brother said all I could do was stand there with his hands balled up in his pockets wanting to hurt this man that was hurting his favorite older sister. But he was a young boy. And my younger sister said, yeah, we went out to, I thought we were going to go get something to eat, but he took me to like a girly show. She was underage and young. And I don't even remember them being on that trip. I remember my father standing by the door not coming in, and I remember my mother crying. And I remember going and sitting at that bar stool at the Mousetrap Bar, ordering my rock glass full of gold, no salt, no lime, fill it to the top. I don't know how many I threw down, and the fire didn't go out. No Lauren Bacall showed up that night. I knew what I had become to that family. I knew that I had broken their hearts, and alcohol didn't work for me like the medicine I needed it to work. And, you know, it wasn't going to do that all the time, but it was turning on me. And my alcoholism, the next 3 years, just got deeper and darker. And I took a lot of geographics. I told you I'd stick my thumb out in the middle of the night, and I went up and found that guy. His parole board had found this love of my life, and he ended up back in St. Louis where he was on parole. And he ended up back up there, and one night I got in my car, and I thought, we never discussed him leaving. And I was sitting in a bar drinking with my drag queen friends, actually, and we decided to pack up my stuff, and they went through my closet is what they did, you know, one of my clothes. And I packed stuff up, and before I even got out of New Orleans, I had forgot to lock the car, and somebody ripped me all off, and I don't care. I got my cooler. I got the things to keep me up, and I'm on my way to St. Louis from New Orleans to find this guy to discuss him leaving me after 2 years. And I should have been happy he was gone. And I found him after about 2 months of living in St. Louis. And he got off his Harley and he took off his helmet and he broke the window with his helmet as a police car pulled up, where it would have gotten probably pretty messy. And he pulled me out by my hair, spit in my face, said, if I ever see you again, I will kill you. Oh, okay, the relationship's probably over now. That's the way I let go. You know, the little pretty butterfly that leaves you, you hunt it down and kill it, you know? And I told this story to my second sponsor. I was about 5 years sober, and she said, you remind me of the girl with the turd. I said, what? You know, it's a sponsor lore. They look in a book, and they can, you know, a baby at the airport going to have a slip. Tell them the Stella story, you know, how she burned up in a bed. Okay, that I got that one, too, at 11 months of sobriety because I wouldn't finish my inventory either. She said, go have fun on your slip and burn up in a bed. Well, I was so mad I wrote that night. I'll show her. And but you know, this sponsor, that's, she said, you're like the girl with this thing in your pocket, and you have your hand around it, and it's so wonderful, and there was a girl in our group like that. She just had this thing, and she wouldn't let us see what it was. She put it in her pocket, and then she was kind of crazy. She said, I'm thinking she's relating me to this girl here. I don't like this, but I'll be respectful to Ginny, so I shut up, and I want to see where this is going. She said, and then one day she trusted me and let me look in her hand to see what she had been guarding, and it was an old, dried-up turd. You know? I wanted to know what kind of turd, you know? I mean, what kind of turd? You know, she just looked at me and I said, well, it belonged to me. It's my turd, you know, and that was my life. It was my turd. Leave me alone. I'll hang on to my turd, you know? I didn't get that, but, you know, it took me a couple of years, so I don't let go easily. You know, I'm one of those loyal Leos. I'll hang on your leg. You drag me out the door. If we're not done, we're not done, you know? It was such a defect of character. Now I've learned how to turn those pieces of quality that God gave me into assets by shaving off, bouncing off the walls. I love working with new people. They hit this side of the wall because they never speak up. So they hit this side of the wall of never talking, never speaking up, and never sharing their feelings to that side of the wall where they won't shut up, and they're in the coffee shop one-upping everybody with their stories. You know, I love it when that happens. And I have to tell them, somewhere in the hitting the wall, you're passing through reality. You know, somewhere in there. That's when you can kind of get your character working and who you are and all of that. But, I hit the walls for a long time. But I came in here crawling. I had no worth as a human being. And my friend was shot and killed in 1975, Mardi Gras Day. I ended up running, and I ran to New York, and I came to California, and I saw the Big Book in a bar, Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood. That's where the Big Book was. And this girl was so drunk that Billy the bartender took away her keys, called a cab, and all of us in the bar just gave her a toast as she went out the door. Good for you, Chris. Go to A&A. Well, she kind of staggered out with this Big Book in her hands and I guess went off to her A&A meeting. And Chris was always nice to me. She was the one who was sober 7, 8 times. She's the one whose phone number was there the day that I gave up. I didn't know, but her example to me of Alcoholics Anonymous was that she was always nice to me. That's it. She just was always nice to me. She bought me drinks. She let me sleep on her floor. You know, she gave me clothes and jewelry, and she was nice to me. And I don't relate any of this other than the day that my day, August 20th, 1975, her number was there, sitting in front of me at a man's house that I was staying at. He happened to be dating her. And I had just been through a victim of violent crime and had my jaw broken in 3 places and thrown out of a car and had to go back to court, and this was outside of Palm Springs, and those are the kind of people I was running with. And I remember at some point in that evening, because this all went to court and it came out in court, the man who was the neighbor, he said, "Yeah, I just heard somebody screaming and then they stopped." And I remembered thinking, when he said that, I was just about a month sober. I remember thinking, oh yeah, I stopped screaming. I thought, who the hell cares anyway? Let's just end this. I was 25 years old and I stopped screaming. I stopped fighting for myself. I gave that big piece of me up, that survivor. But the great fact deep down within each one of us when we come here is still an ember ready to get fired up. And when you walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you walk into this kind of these people, this tribe, the action ones, the verb people, they're going to put a little kindling on your ember. They're going to help you fan your fire. They're not going to let you sit and let it go out. They're not going to say, oh, well, next Saturday we'll come pick you up. Hang in there for a week. You know, they're going to pick you up. They're going to sit there with the liquor store, because I'm living above a liquor store with this guy that day I called, and this girl, Chris, because her number was there. Because my mother had said no when I called her for some money. She said, try the Salvation Army. My mother didn't sleep for 2 nights when I was in this hospital for 2 weeks. She just, for 2 nights, she didn't know where I was. She had heard something had happened to me by a phone call, but they didn't tell her where I was. So my mother in Iowa, my sister in New York, called all the hospitals in California to find me. And thank you, I am overpaid that my mother sleeps at night because of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother doesn't worry that the phone's going to ring at 3 or 4 in the morning. Thank you. That's huge benefit of being sober, is that my mother doesn't have to worry about me anymore. It's not about me. If you're sitting in this room, there's 10 people right now that are praying for you that you probably don't even know, that love you and care about you, whether they've let you go or not. that thank God my mother let me go. Because I called that number, that girl that day. I had my wired jaw. I'm trying to talk to Chris. She said, oh, you got to call Suzanne. She wasn't sober that day. That was the girl who walked out the door at 8 and never came back. She died at 31. And I saw her in the hospital. She was 31 years old, and she was not herself anymore. But she was there that day. She was always nice to me. She was an example of somebody I could call. That's it. And her number was there. And she got me to somebody who was sober 5 years. I don't know. I just know that I have nowhere to go. I have this wired up face. I have no money. And I'm tired. Finally, I'm tired. So I go and sit on the steps of the liquor store, and this bright yellow Volkswagen pulls up. It hurt to look at it. And these girls got out that hurt to look at because they were so shiny. Everything about them was clean and shiny. And I just, my head said, I'm not going anywhere with them. But I was so tired, they just lifted me up and put me in the back of this Volkswagen where I couldn't get out at the next red light. There's no doors, you know. And they talked about themselves all the way to where we're going. I don't know where we're going. But this woman that had set up this 12-step call with her two most beautiful babies had said, don't drink anything and don't use anything either. Put your joint down. And I thought, how does she know I have both? At that moment, I called, you know. I was very curious as to who these people were, but I needed a place to stay, and that's why I came. And we go to this church, and I thought, oh, no, I've been there, done that. They're going to want something forever. I can't do eternity. I live a day at a time. And I walk up to the door, and the man at the suit had a suit on, and I thought he was the minister, and I thought he was going to put me in the kitchen behind him because I knew he wouldn't let me sit with the bunch of people that were nice and cleaned up. And he was going at me really fast, and he said, welcome. I don't know what that's about. Welcome? Yeah, but I can't talk, so it's really, I just have to, you know, first 3 months in AA, I couldn't talk. It's just a beautiful blessing. I had to learn to listen. And I don't know how they knew I was new. No. I detoxed in AA. You know, I hadn't bathed in a while. I love my girls. They come in my room, and they said, the cabin over there said, oh, it smells like you, Sharon, you know, and they like my smell, which is Tiffany perfume. I think, boy, I wasn't smelling like Tiffany that night. But I love that smell. To me, that stale out, in fact, Johnny, we're going to sniff on you later, that coming out of your pores, I love that smell. I love getting in an elevator on Monday morning in my work building and go, oh, good, there's someone on here, you know, is really knocking it back. And it's coming out of their pores, and it's stale, and it's good. It's like Tiffany perfume to me. I like that. You know, a couple years ago, really, because people, you know, clean up, and then come to AA, you can't tell the new from the old sometimes. One of the girls I sponsored, our big Wednesday night meeting, said, oh, my God, somebody over there smells like alcohol. I was like, okay, we're in AA. Could happen. Could happen. And let's go find him. So we went and found him, and, you know, she'd never even met, like, a wet drunk. And I got sober in 1975, and as we know, we had a lot of 12-step calls. I'm a B, so I, like, got picked really a lot. And I lived by the airport, so I got to go to seedy motels, just like me with my black eye and, you know, the cat that hasn't been fed, and the guy passed out on the bed, and I drag her off to a meeting, and she'd disrupt, and the old-timers would have to help me with them, and I was like, I was so proud. You know, it felt so good, and then I'd bring her back and read the book and underline some stuff and give her some pamphlets, and then she'd pass out, and I'd never hear from her again. You know, she'd wake up with all this stuff, you know, which was, I always wanted to see their face, but I would always feel so good. I would stay sober. You know, I would always feel so good in these 12-step calls. I think they're starting to come back. Joe and I were talking earlier. I think there's a trend. You know, we're starting to see a couple of seizures at Ohio Street again. You know, it's starting to, some things are happening. People are detoxing in AA again. So I think it's a very exciting time. It's a very exciting time. But, you know, I came to this meeting with my jaw wired shut. I didn't know how they knew I was new. They raised my hand. They gave me a book. I gave him my last quarter because I was way too confused about payment terms. I didn't know what he was talking payment terms. I gave him my last quarter. There's a guy named Maurice who's no longer with us, and he was a Hollywood writer, and he was a great guy. And he says, Sharon, he came to my watch. When I turned one, we sit at coffee shops and watch them turn one so that they don't go anywhere. We watch them. We don't let them up out of the booth, and they don't go to the bathroom alone, and it's very fun. So Maurice came to my watch, and he said, I knew you'd stay sober because you paid me back for that book, one quarter at a time. One quarter at a time. I didn't want to owe you guys anything. People would give me rides, I'd write it down. People would give me clothes, I'd write it down. People would give me $5, I'd write it down. And one night a man walked over, old-timer our group, Chuck Nesbitt, walked over and said, what are you doing? And of course, he didn't wait for an answer because I'm wired shut. And he looked at it and he said, Sharon, put that book away. He says, one day you're going to have a car. Driver's license, insurance, registered, all in the same name. How do you know that? Got my attention. He said, you'll be able to give newcomers rides. Someday you're going to have a couch where someone can sleep on. Someday you're going to be able to clean out your closet and give some clothes to that new girl who's starting a job. That's the way we want to be paid back, pass it on. Oh, he trusted me with something there. He trusted me with something there. You know, he loved me. That man gave me some love that night. He's also the one who walked over to me when I was new. He said, take your pack off and stay with us for a while. You look tired. He was the old timer in the room who always spotted the newcomers and went out of his way. He's the old timer in the room that taught us how to die with dignity. He had cancer and he went with dignity. You know, we teach each other so much here. We're such an amazing community. You know, if I have people that need something that I haven't gone through, there's someone in the room who has. There's always someone in the room who stayed sober through a situation. You don't have to ever do anything alone again. There's proof here. There's proof here. And I just, I started to feel like I was loved. I got the sponsor, and I went from a floor to a couch. I got to sleep on her couch. And it was like a plus for sponsorship. If you get a sponsor, your life gets better. And I got a couch. So here I am on her couch, and she's making me pray. Oh. You know, I don't want God to know where I am. And so I wait till the whole house is asleep. You know, 2 a.m, I kind of slide out of the couch and get on my knees and I slide back up. And she had to write the prayer down. Thank you for all you've given me. Thank you for all you've taken away from me. Thank you for all you've left me. Because I couldn't remember it. She had to write it down for me. And I'd slide back in bed and, okay, nothing happened. Good. And I was really afraid. I had been living in fear so much in my life that I had this sponsor that loved me more than I deserved. She gave me her best, and Janet was crazy. She needed to have her best to stay sane in the world. She needed to show up and be active and do everything, and that's what she wanted from me. She gave it to me exactly like she got it. She didn't water it down. She didn't go on theories and generalities. She gave me her best, and that's what we want for you. We're going to show you where the tools are. You got to use them. You know, I was such a good manipulator. I had everybody doing things for me when I was growing up. I never learned to sew on a button because I would manipulate. I had got an A in home ec and sewing, but I never could even thread a needle in the machine because I would manipulate people to help me all the time. And I didn't learn anything. And staying teachable and working with others and sitting in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to climb to new views continually and not be disappointed. It's like the hike we were on today. Every little stop had a new view. You have to work hard to get to the new spot, and it had a new view. And I've never been disappointed spiritually with the new views that you've shown me here. And the people ahead of me, carrying the torch high. And I do stand on the shoulders of giants. People that have loved me and cared about me and held me up and let me see over their shoulders to what's down the road. As long as you stay here, as long as you give it away. And that's the way I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am still in that home group today. Our first third step was on our knees, out of the book, just like it, just like it says, with my sponsor. And then we got up when it was all done, and she hugged me so tight, and she wouldn't stop, and so long, and it was just bad. I was like, I was stiff as a board. I didn't like being touched. And my jaw's still wired shut, and her kids are home, and she won't stop hugging me. And then it felt great. It felt so good having this person hug me and love me. I just had this flip. And I thought, that's it. I love my sponsor. I'm in love with my sponsor, and I am probably gay. So we have to deal with it. You know? And I'm telling you this, so that's the way my emotions worked, you know. I go to a meeting at night, and I'd just be grinding my teeth. This was after the jaws were unwired, and somebody would say, you know, you look a little angry. Yeah, I am. And they go, well, did you eat today? oh, no, I forgot. You know, it's like anger or hunger. I didn't know. I was so computer wires all over the floor. Nothing was sparking, you know, and every once in a while something had sparked, and it's like, oh, wow, you know, 2 weeks later, you know, like, I should have said this, you know. Why did I tell him that, you know, and I'd lay awake all night, and I was just so emotionally not in the moment, and I had to learn how to wash coffee cups, and that sponsor would say, okay, just wash the cup, all you're doing. That was my commitment, was washing the cup after this Wednesday night meeting. Okay, good. And then I give it to the jerk who would dry it. I didn't like him at all. And he was from Texas and scared me, his accent. And I only made it through Texas by the hair of my chinny chin 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 once. There was enough in my socks to put me up forever. And that Mountie looked down at my socks, looked up at me, and said, keep on driving. I said, yes, sir. Back in the old days. But God bless Mike. He's another one who went out that we buried. I don't know why I'm here, other than I just stayed. And Junan was the lady I stayed with for a while, and she was always mad at her sponsor. It was Clancy, and we would go out afterwards, and I'm still wired up when I'm staying with her, and I can't eat or drink or anything, and I was trying to drink some coffee at the coffee shop. And it's dribbling down my face, and I don't realize that it is running down the side of my cheek where I had no feeling for a long time. And there's a puddle under me, and I am horrified when I realize what I am doing. And Pat looked up. She was talking to Jan, complaining about her sponsor. And Pat Hodges looked up at me. And I thought, oh, she's going to laugh and say, look at Sharon. She's such a slob. Look at her. She can't even drink through that broken jaw. Come on. She looked up at me, and she saw the panic in my eyes. And I remember this moment like it was yesterday. And God bless Pat. She died sober. She was such an amazing woman. She took her napkin, she put it up to the corner of my cheek, put it down on the puddle of coffee, and winked at me and went back to our conversation. I hadn't been touched by that kind of love in a long time. And that's the best. I just got the best. I was treated like I was a piece of gold that they had mined. And I had nothing to give, except I showed up, I stayed sober in between meetings, and they loved me. I didn't want any of it, but they loved me. And I stayed long enough to endure the beams of love, because that's what it was. I had to endure this for a long time. And Junan was great. She was cookie girl. I was cup washer at this one meeting. And she went off to buy the cookies. And, you know, if you want an important job, go be cookie or coffee, because they'll miss those if they're not there, you know. I remember when I got to be cookie girl, and if I got mad at the old-timer, I would not buy his cookies for a couple of months. Sense of power. Clint would say, where's the Fig Newtons? I go, I don't know, they were out. Because he yelled at me for spilling coffee on his hand or something. But Junan was cookies, and I was cup washer, so she'd drop me off, go get the cookies, and she didn't come back, and the meeting's going to start, and everybody wants their cookies, and they're, well, where's Junan? I don't know, she's, you know. And all of a sudden, the black and white LAPD pulls up to the curb, and this cop gets up, and he walks up, and he's talking to the secretary of the meeting. And we're going, well, where's Judan? And you know, the cop's there, and he goes, she's in the car. She's in the car. She bought these cookies, and then she went back and shoplifted some candy bars. They called me, and so I have to take her in, but she convinced me to stop and drop the cookies off. You know, so I thought, you know what? That's commitment, man. That's commitment. Those are the kind of people I learn from. No matter what, you get the job done. And I had to go waitress, and I was like a rotten waitress. I had a bad attitude. People would ask me how I was. I would tell them, you know. Nobody wants to sit in my station anymore. Even the Culver City Clubhouse AAers after their meeting would go, no, we're going to go over here. Nobody wanted to sit. I was a downer. You know, and one night I was at the... I was at the meeting, and I had to go work a split shift, and I had my orange on and my brown apron and those white shoes, and feeling sorry for myself, and they said, well, how's the tip, Sharon? How's it going there? And bad. Bad. It's going bad there. Well, maybe change your attitude. Well, what do you mean? You know, just give them hot food and give them a smile. It's like, no. This is AA. We're supposed to be honest in all our affairs. You know, it's a smart comeback. That was not my sponsor there at the time, or I wouldn't have been talking like that, you know, because she intimidated me a little bit. Louder than my head. If you don't have a sponsor, get one louder than your head. It's really a good thing. So they brought over Sally C., the Queen Bee Allen, on, and they said, okay, fake it till you feel it. Look, Sally, show her how to do this. And I pushed up the corners of my mouth, and I said, they're going to know I'm phony all night long. And they said, just try it. All right, I'm going to show you. It's not going to work. So I waited on people all night long. Hi, how are you? Fine, how are you? May I help you? And I just had this phony smile on my face all night long. And, you know, by, I don't know, three quarters of the way through, I'm counting my, boy, I made twice as much money. And it's like, these people are smart, you know. I called my sponsor one morning. I had the migraine. I had to work at like a 7 a.m. shift, and I knew I had that brain tumor was coming, and I called her. I'm tying those white shoes, and I'm crying, and she said, first I woke her up. Don't wake your sponsor up to whine. No whining. Don't wake your sponsor up to whine. It won't work. And she said, okay. She said, you know what? If you go to work and you die at work, we're going to give you the best send-off that this group has ever seen. We're going to say great things about you. We'll have flowers. We'll have music. Your family will be so proud. But if you die at home in bed, there is no funeral. And she slammed the phone down. And she made me mad. I got so mad at her, I thought, I'm going to go be Miss AA today. I'm going to just be a perfect example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the time I was of service, I forgot about what a, you know, I forgot about myself. See, when I'm of service, I forget about myself. You know, I pray in the morning. I meditate in the morning. I have faith, you know. And it turns into some kind of love, and then I get to be of service, and when I go home at night, I have some peace. I was in the 60s. I marched for peace. I did a lot of things for peace. You know? Peace for a piece, I guess. I don't know. Take that off the tape, will you? But being of service is what brings me peace. And I had to go back and make those amends after my first fourth step that I did. And Janet put me on the plane, and I was home a week, and I hadn't done it with my dad yet. He's going to, you know, I don't want to do this with my father. I did it with my mother, and we're putting the bags in the car, and that sponsor's going to pick me up at the airport. She's going to just be so mad if I don't do these amends with my dad, you know, and she intimidated me. She was louder than my head. We're putting the bags in the car. We're going back to Los Angeles from Iowa, and I said, oh, I better do it right now. And I told my dad I needed to talk to him, and he said, okay. And we leaned by the car, and I remember that moment. It was an Indian summer, September, Iowa day. I was a little over a year sober, and the sun was warm on our backs, and the car was warm. And we stood there leaning against the car, and I said what I had to say to my dad, and we looked at our feet, and nobody hugged, and the earth didn't move, and the angels didn't sing. And he just said, I always wanted you to be happy, Sharon. And that was it. Get back in. I get at the airport. She said, you do it? And I said, yeah, I did it. She said, well, that's a start. You got to call home every week. You got to show up at their house at least once a year. You got to take a trip back to Iowa, maybe more. And you have to include them in your life. And it was a start. And at 2.5 years of sobriety, my dad came out with my mom and my sisters and Boy Meets Girl in AA campus, and we got married. This guy in the sober 6 more months than me in my home group. And my dad went to an AA meeting with me because he was curious with what you were doing with his daughter. There's no alcoholism in my family. Nobody gets it. So he came to an AA meeting about the big book. He thought you guys were all great. And at the end of my wedding day, somebody snapped a picture, which I found again a couple of years ago in a shoebox when I was going through some things. And there's a picture of my dad and me. And I've got my wedding garb on and my chin on my hand. And I'm looking my dad in the eye, and he's looking me in the eye. And I remember what he was telling me. He says, Sharon, look at your life. Look at the people here. You got it made. If you think about doing what you were doing before, think twice. And I remember at that moment thinking, I am not going to make this moment about me and go, you're right, Dad. It's about time you noticed. Am I making you proud now? I just shut up. And somebody snapped a picture and gave it to me. And we're looking at each other's eyes. It had been years since my father and I could sit in the same room emotionally comfortably. It had been years. And at 2.5 years, we were now able to look each other in the eyes and have a little conversation. And I had another sponsor at 5 years of sobriety, Ginny, who had me call up my dad. I got a better job, made more money. She said, it's time to pay him back the money you owe him. Well, how do you know about that? I didn't take that whole inventory with her. It's sponsor school again. You know, they just kind of go by routine. And married a couple years, complaining about her husband, time to make financial amends to her father. Okay. So I called up my dad, and I told him what I was going to do, and he said, okay, it's this much. He gave me a figure. He had been ready for me. He read the big book. He ran a calculator tape. He circled it in red and put it on page 78. Most alcoholics owe money. Told my mother, if I'm not home, Sharon stays sober long enough, gets to this part of the book. This is the bottom line right here. I had a new resentment. But my sponsor said, okay, yeah, right. Okay, now call him back in 2 days and see, you know, she didn't care about my new resentment. See if he'll accept your payment terms. And he did. I called her back and said he accepted. You know, in the meantime, of course, the fight I was having with my husband, that's all over because I'm focused on this new thing. You know, that's what you do with newcomers. They're all, like, intense over here. You just kind of move them to the other side of the field, and you tell them, look at the coyote scat over here. Enjoy, you know, look at that for a while. Out of this scat, we're going to plant some seeds that's going to grow into a garden. You know, that's Jimmy Ryan used to talk like that from Texas, you know. The willingness without action is fantasy. And he said, you know, if you're new, we know you got a lot of fertilizer. He looked right at me. I said, what is he talking about? He said, we're going to make a pretty garden out of that. He said, the reason the grass was greener is because another guy took care of his lawn. You know, it's like, oh, okay. So you take the newcomer over here and have him look in the fertilizer for a while. As this problem works out, just keep him entertained and the problem will work out. And that's what she was doing. I was so focused on this thing with my father. And I called him back and he said, okay, he accepted my terms. I called her back. I said, he accepted. She said, then you are not going to be late with a check for your father. You are not going to be late because you're the only example that you may ever see. Your father may not know another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Make it a good example. And they've always pulled that on me, and I stand up a little straighter and taller every time they pull that on me. Oh, example. Oh, my God, that's right, because that girl Chris was the example of being nice to me. Her number was there. I may be the only example my dad ever sees of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's like, oh, my God, that's a heavy one, you know? But I stand up straighter and taller, and I shine up a little bit more because I represent you, and I don't ever let you down, ever. So she said, you know what? Are you really willing to grow through this and heal with this with your dad? I'm going to say no. You know, you're painted in the corner, and good sponsors want one more thing from you, as you can't wiggle out, you know. They just want that one more thing that has made a huge difference in your life, looking back on it. And so I said, okay, what? And I said, okay, what? You know, and she said, send a note with that check. Do not send the cold, hard cash. About your life, and just tell them about it. I said, well, you know, I'm the only non-college graduate. I'm the only alcoholic. I'm the only, you know, she said she didn't care. She said, do it anyway. Oh. So I sent the check and the little note, little tiny piece of paper. Something like, I hope you get this, and I hope you're fine. Tell Mom hi. Something like 3 or 4 lines. Did you send the check and the note? Yes. You know, they remember that for a couple of months. And then I don't know if it was the first or the second Dad's Day of sending my father this check. But I remember not having an anxiety attack over Dad's Day cards in the, you know, the Hallmark store. I could just pick out a card and sign it. And I remember writing my dad a letter, and I thought, God, I haven't written my father a letter since I was 10 years old in camp. And she'd get the check and the note and the check and the card and the check and something written for me for 4 3/4 years, an example of Alcoholics Anonymous, not about me, it's bigger than me. And my father called me between Christmas and New Year's. He said, Merry Christmas, Sharon, I don't want your money anymore. And, of course, I quickly calculated. I think I got off about 2 years light, you know. No more money, but don't stop sending me your notes. And my dad and I got to heal up. We got to heal up. I did not think that the innocence could come back in my life like it did. But because of a wise sponsor, some great amends, and a lot of loving God, my dad and I had a lot of good years together. I got to go home and be his little girl. I got to go home and listen to him talk about how hard it was getting older in life, losing your place in the community. Part of me wanted to go, okay, Dad, let me give you some tools for living, you know? But see, I had this God in my life, my now, and this God just said, just shut up and listen. And I got to go home and just shut up and listen to my dad for a lot of years. Yeah, 5 years ago he was killed. And it was quick and it was over and it was on his land and the tractor went over and it was over. And, you know, my sponsor said that was for him. It was quick and it was fast and it was a pretty day. And my dad would not have been the type to sit in a nursing home ever. And, you know, I went home and AA was already there. And I got to play my dad an accordion number on his accordion. And my sponsor was now Clancy. He's been my sponsor for 19 years almost. Because my second sponsor smoked pot after 21 years. But she's back with about eight. And Clancy was out of town when my dad was killed, and I got on this plane and I went back, and AA was already there, and the flowers were at the church from many of you that just knew me, didn't even know my dad. And I have to play this accordion number at his wake because I have to. And it's his accordion, and he's Czech, and he has this button accordion with buttons on both sides. And, you know, I played one of those beautiful piano accordions with the buttons here and the piano, black and white ivory keys. And I don't know how to play this accordion, my father's, but I am working on it all day long. I'm making my Iowa babies come in and do shifts with me. How does that sound, you know? And then they would go out of the room with their heads spinning, and a new one would come in, you know? Because I don't get the buttons both ways, and I'm working hard on it. And I'm at the wake, and somebody said something to me that made me mad, and I just went over to the rectory, and I called Clancy. He's back from South Africa now. And I said, hi, let me talk to Clancy, midnight mission. He didn't answer. I hung up. I'm on hold. I called back. I thought, okay, tell him he's got 60 seconds. You know, this is my father's wake. I'm making it about me now. Because I'm a sick alcoholic, and something sent me off, and those family dynamics and the triggers and the things we fall back in, I just sit back when I can now, and I'm amongst all that. I just laugh at the person that wants to come out. She's so hilarious, you know. Thank God I can laugh at her and make new choices, but not that night I wasn't. So Clancy got on after like 48 seconds, you know. I said, I need to talk to you. And he said, you know, he had heard what had happened, and he was being kind and loving, and he was just back from this, you know, overseas trip, and I told him I've worked all hard on this accordion number all day long, and you know, and I don't know if I can do it, and somebody hurt my feelings, and he listened. It was a good sponsor, Will, and then he got louder than my head, and he said, Sharon, you're going to do a great job. You'll just do this for your father. I know you will. It'll be great. It'll be fine. But I want you to look around that church and just look at everybody crying. There's not going to be a dry eye in that church. You know, he's making me feel better now. He said, but I want you to look at the ones that are sobbing, just sobbing, because those are the musicians. and that's my sponsor, you know. It's louder than my head. And you have loved my mother ever since my dad's been gone after almost 58 years of marriage. She's going to go to the Iowa 4th of July of AA. She always does. She'll bring her brownies. She bakes these date brownies. I've got girls I sponsor there that call every week and come by and see her. And my brother's wife said, you know what? Your mother's friends don't come by that much anymore, but the AAs are always there. I can't be there, so they are there for me. I can't be there all the time. I just adore my mother. She is an amazing spirit. I got her in like this close to the Pope because of Father Tom. Boy, was I the family hero for a moment. Yes, you know. And she's done a lot of traveling with my sister and with my other sister and me and my brother. And she's just out there because she has a great faith. And, you know, I sponsor a lot of women, and I've been able to make amends to them, to the world, because of some of the women I sponsor. One being a nun. I had to go back to this Catholic church and wait for her, and they started talking about peace and love, and nobody came and asked me to leave, and I would tell Sheila, well, you know, I want to go to Easter Sunday, but I haven't gone to confession, and she'd go, oh, don't worry about it. Oh, Sheila said, don't worry about it. Okay, so I can still show up for Mass, and, you know, and then my son, who was born in 84, just turned 20 last Wednesday, he got kicked out of kindergarten, and I was going through a very messy, bad divorce for a lot of years. He got a little bit boisterous. My ex-husband, who's still sober, but I don't know how active he is, he lives up in the mountains, he married the newcomer in the room. And it wasn't fun, and it wasn't pretty, and I've been able to share my story with a lot of people because of nobody got custody of the meetings, and everybody has now ended up where they're supposed to be. And the second wife had a boy, and she's my best friend. She's on my speed dial. She gives me cakes every year. We have Mother's Day together with the kids, and they've been divorced about 10 years now. So, you know, how they come is how they go sometimes. And you know, and she told me that she was, when he left her, she knew she could do it because she had watched me walk through it with dignity and grace. And it wasn't because I'm a wonderful person. It was because my sponsor, Clancy, happened to be the other night. I was going to throw hot coffee on them in the room. The second one, the newcomer and him. And he stopped me and he took the coffee out of my hands and he got louder than my head. He said, "You'll walk through this with dignity and grace." And if he would have stopped there, I would have said, "I don't care. I want revenge. I'm going with coffee." He said, "So you could be an example to others." And she told me that when he left her, that she knew she could do it because I was her example. So if you're thrown into the swamp of alligators, your job is to keep on swimming, you know. Just keep on swimming. That's what we're all here coaching each other. Just keep on swimming. The island is near. The island is near. And 1 year, 1 month, and 14 days, I sat in that hallway of pain, and I went to pick up Sister Sheila at St. Augustine's Church because my kid was there. In their kindergarten, I put him with the Catholics, and I had this clunk, this shift, something opened up in my heart and in my gut, and I felt all the way through, tip of my head to tip of my toes, God's love again. I was healed up again. I was able to move on, and the doors opened to a beautiful view, and I've never looked back. I've never looked back, and I am... You know, I've been able to work the carnival at the St. Augustine School Carnival year after year after year after year after year until my son graduated from 8th grade. I worked that carnival. I bought ride tickets. I gave things away. I counted their money. Okay, maybe now the carnival thing is done. I didn't know how I was going to ever make amends for that, ever. And you've given me ways to do that by being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, by keeping my eyes open, by looking for the next beam of light. Sometimes I can't see all the way down the road. I just got to look at where, okay, somebody needs something, that's where I go. Leads me to here, leads me to there, and that's the way I find my way. God is already handling all of my problems. I have this amazing, loving God that is already handling all of my problems. My job is to just look for the next way to be of service. That's it. It's really simple. It's already being handled. You know, it's like I wake up in the morning, you know, I don't need to ask for anything. God already knows. He knows what I want. He knows my needs. My job is to wake up, to open my eyes, to have my moment, to have that, it's a new day, it's not, oh God, it's a new day, it's good morning, God, it's a new day. I don't jump out of bed to work on defects, though. I don't go, oh God, let me work on jealousy today, that's right. You know, I have to have a little pain, be back in the corner, have some sponsors, be an example to those new girls, have them need something from me that I can grow with them, stay teachable, and then... But I don't wake up wanting to change and have pain and hurt. I don't do that. I'm still not into that, you know. It's when life will give me enough experiences to grow. I don't have to seek it out and give you my glass full of self-worth and say, knock it on the floor. I worked real hard for this. I got some of your tears in there, too. Come on, knock it on the floor. Think about doing that action. Wait until the sun comes up. We all turn into werewolves at night, you know. And take a good look on what you're thinking about in the morning. You know, unload the gun. You know, think about it in the morning. You know, whatever it is, take a good look at what you have to have across the room, that newcomer or whatever it is. Look at it in the sunlight. I do not make major decisions. I learned that in Al-Anon. 8 o'clock at night, after 8 o'clock at night, I make no major decisions. I don't have big conversations even. You know, it's just something happens to the alcoholics at night, you know. And I've learned how to let it, just the sun come up on it. And I've had a good life. I've had a really good life, and I feel like I don't know what I want to be when I grow up, but I'm on the path. I'm on the path with my sponsor and people ahead holding the torch. Dave and I stood up. We have 28 going on 29 years, and I'm thinking, you know, right behind us is Polly and a lot of you, but where's the one with 30 in the room? I need somebody there, you know? I'm not ready to have the torch passed to me yet. Yeah, if I got to do a little relay, I'll do it. I will. But I need those old timers. I respect them. I show up every Wednesday night and I get them coffee and I respect them and I look nice and we welcome the newcomers in the room. And that's my life. I work, I'm self-supporting. I have a great guy in my life. I had Casey's been in my life for 17 years. We don't live together. We're busy in AA. We're busy in our lives. I've been raising my child. And gratitude is the basis of the passion in our lives. Gratitude for being seconds and inches saved from the disease of alcoholism, the lonely, locked-up disease of alcoholism. My heart has sprung open. That's it. When I see the girls I sponsor and the girls they sponsor, the light go on in their eyes because they've just found the doorknob and they've cracked it open a little bit. The doorknob's on the inside. And they've let me in, and they've let some light in. There's nothing better than watching that miracle happen in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. It renews me. It gives me a huge log on my fire. I have a dog and three cats that are all rescued, and we meditate in the morning. I've got them all trained now. So if I'm not on the couch, they're sitting there going, come on, get up here. Come on. I have to have accountability wherever I go. So, it's like... They're waiting for me, and, it's real simple. It's just real simple. My prayers are just to become half the person that my dog thinks I am. It's really very simple. I just do that because, she thinks I'm great no matter what. I just be half the person, go out in the world, look for the next beam of light, be of service, keep my heart open, stay teachable, sit in the middle of you, linked up. My job is to keep my link strong. And if you need a log for my fire, you come take it. Welcome, Johnny. Shanette, happy birthday. Debbie and Jen, Wendy, Rachel, Dee, Beth, Kayleen, all the beautiful women I spent time with. Erica, thank you so much for being ironing my skirt with Jesse's iron. Oh, Jesse brought the iron. And just loving me this weekend. You are my tribe. When you climb to the top of the mountain at the top of the world, don't look down. Grow wings. Thanks.